Welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast, episode 14, 2016. I'm Matt Stalnick, joined by my usual co-host Aaron Bearden, talking post-Kentucky in the NASCAR world. Got a lot to cover on this episode tonight for you folks. Got rules packages, we got Team Penske, Brad Keselowski, domination, pit road penalties, NBC, all kinds of stuff. So Aaron, the big story coming out of this weekend was obviously all of the changes that were inherent to the Kentucky weekend. You had a new track surface, you had a different tire combination, you had a new rules package. It led to I'm not going to say a bad race, because it definitely was not a bad race, a very unusual race, a very intriguing race. It was one of the more unique races I think we've seen this year so far. So give me your evaluation on the second run with this low downforce package, just in case anyone hasn't been paying attention. This was the second attempt by NASCAR this past week in his race, trying to run the 2017 package. So give me your breakdown of what stood out to you this weekend, specifically with those rules packages.
I think one of the biggest quotes I heard in regards to the downforce package itself was actually from Brad Keselowski. For any who don't know, he more or less made a big move to get around Kevin Harvick late and then stretch his fuel, obviously, and won the race. And he said in the post-race press conference, if it wasn't for the low downforce package that they were running, he wouldn't have won that race. He didn't believe that, and with the package they had, even with the normal low downforce package, on that repaved track with those harder tires where track position was so vital and passing was so difficult, Keselowski himself came out and said, hey, if it wasn't for this package, I wouldn't have been able to make that pass. And above all else, I think that was arguably the biggest quote I heard from the whole weekend in regards to the downforce package itself. As for analyzing it, you know, from I've been at both races. Michigan, it was very noticeable because there weren't any other variables really at stake or at play. With this race in particular, with the repaved track, which was also reconfigured, and Goodyear bringing such a hard compound from the scares from the test a couple weeks ago on the 13th and 14th, it was very hard to see what exactly was from that downforce package and what was just from, for example, the surface, because you saw quite a few drivers wreck in turn 3 and 4 because they changed that turn so much and made it so challenging. And then there were drivers taking two tire stops all night and made track position really difficult because the tire wear was so different compared to most races. I think that personally, just from watching it, I definitely think that the low downforce package helped. I think you saw going into turns that drivers were able to set each other up and make passes more often than I think you've seen in any repave in recent history. Really since 2008, when they had the Indianapolis tire debacle, Goodyear's been very conservative with tires on these repaved tracks, and it's led to some of the worst races, quite frankly, we've had when these tracks have been recently repaved. And that's, I mean, it's just been part of the business, obviously, a newer track. As weird as it is to think, new can actually be bad in NASCAR. But the package helped. Overall, coming from Scott Miller, the vice president of competition, Brad Keselowski, I think Carl Edwards said something to the tune of it too. The basic consensus was that, no, this wasn't the greatest race that we've had here. It obviously didn't live up to last year's race at Kentucky, which was just a thriller and a classic. But considering all the variables going into it, they really thought that it was the best race you really could have had on that repaved track.
Yeah, it's interesting because I read all of the post-race commentary from a lot of drivers. One that really stood out to me was Dale Earnhardt Jr. Granted, he was running mid-pack for most of the race. Brad Keselowski was up front for most of the night, so it's always hard to suss out the bias or the lack of bias and who was dealing with different conditions out in the racetrack and whatnot. But Dale Earnhardt Jr. was very, very critical of this package. He was critical of it in Michigan. He was explicitly critical of it this weekend. He basically, the gist of his comments were that the aero balance was off. He agreed that going with the lower downforce is the right way to go, but he basically said that the aero balance wasn't correct, and it's basically made the cars such that they couldn't really race around each other. Compared to Keselowski's comments, as a viewer, From what I saw, my viewing experience lined up more with what Junior was saying. I just don't see what the drivers were saying when they're saying that the racing was improved in some aspect. From what I could tell, and granted, I'm not dismissing the move that Keselowski made on Harvick. That was an old school move, getting somebody aero loose. But I want to point out that that was on a restart, and it was also when the cars were going at a slower speed going into the corner, so he was able to get closer, I think, somewhat artificially. Anytime, I would say, after about three or four laps after a restart, the minute those cars got spread out, you could not close on anybody. And that's not something that we have seen with even the 2016 package, the normal 2016 package. And we've seen that on tracks that were still pretty glass smooth. I mean, you could pass at Kansas this year, you could pass at Charlotte. So I'm very confused as to why the drivers continue to trumpet this, at least some of the drivers continue to trumpet this package, when visually it really doesn't, purely from an aero perspective, it doesn't look like the package has helped, and in fact it's hurt the clean air phenomenon. So I know a lot of the drivers like this package because it's harder to drive, and I know that's one of the biggest things that they're parroting. But my perspective all along has been, I don't necessarily care how hard the cars are to drive if they can't race well around each other. I think it was very clear to me, and granted, it could have been from the repave, it could have been from the tire, it could have been any number of factors, that the cars could not race around each other, and it looked very aero-oriented. I'm not an aerodynamicist. I couldn't tell you exactly why that happened, and I certainly am not qualified to say that it was unquestionably the package's fault. But just from watching races for the past 10, 15 years and getting at least a rudimentary understanding of aero, it looked like this package has been a step back in terms of a car's ability to close in on a car ahead of it. Granted, I think the Keselowski case was certainly interesting, and I think we definitely saw the guys getting each other aero loose. But it seemed to me that the only time they were able to do that was when they were able to get really close up to that car ahead of them. And it seemed to me that once you got into a run, you couldn't really close that 5/10 or so gap. So the question I have is, okay, we all agree that lower downforce is the way to go. We all agree that making the cars harder to drive is a good thing. But I think NASCAR needs to keep going back to the drawing board on this one, because we're not seeing better racing with this package, in my opinion. And I'm a little scared of what's going to happen if they end up going forward with this package, because I don't think it's race ready. It's not. It didn't have that debut like the 2016 package originally did last year. And I think they need to keep looking at it. I don't know if the aero balance is right. That seems to be what a lot of the drivers who have been critical of it have been saying. But I mean, am I missing something? Because that's kind of what I saw.
Well, from what I'm seeing, one thing that I think also needs to be accounted for in this is Goodyear's tire package. Again, after Michigan, for example, Tony Stewart, I remember, said that he loved the package, but he felt that Goodyear was still being conservative with the tires because they really hadn't had to worry about it for a few years because the package was so bad that it didn't affect it. And Stewart challenged Goodyear after Michigan's race, saying that, hey, we're finally getting our stuff better. Now it's going to be time for you guys to make improvements. And I think if you look at the things some of them said after the race at Kentucky, it was that same general consensus, only obviously elevated because with the repave, Goodyear again came in with a more conservative tire. Stewart talked about how, you know, anytime you get a repave, it's easy for us to blame Goodyear, but he kind of faulted them for panicking after the test. And he just sort of acknowledged it was what it was. As for Earnhardt's quotes in particular, I would say his were actually geared more towards the tires than the package after Kentucky. If you want the exact quotes, he said the low downforce, I don't know if it's all that stuff's a great combination, but he followed it by saying the drivers want less downforce. And he said, if you take me to Texas with the tire they ran and wore out old racetrack and a softer tire that gripped the track, he'd love this package. He just said it was a bad combination with the surface and how conservative that tire was. I think one of the big things you're seeing with the low downforce package tested this year compared to last year, I think last year you saw it tested on the old Kentucky surface where it really set it up for great racing, and I think you also saw it tested at a Darlington track, which set it up for great racing, whereas this year they test this new package at Michigan, which, I mean, you can try all you want to help it, but those cars still punch a big hole in the air at Michigan, and that's still a moving target for them. And then they run it at this race where it's really impossible to tell if it was good or not because there is no prior data to really branch off of and look at in regards to this Kentucky race.
The thing that just confuses me is that I compare the old 2014 package. The 2014 package, if anyone remembers, had a ton of downforce on it. And I'm going to use Michigan as an example. The 2014 package was actually racier, and you could close on a car ahead much easier than you could with this lower downforce package, which I thought was kind of shocking. So, I don't know. It's so complicated, and I don't want to assign any fault to anybody. This is not me coming down on anybody. I think it's good that we're testing things and we're trying things, because at the end of the day, Kentucky was not a bad race by any stretch. I thought it was intriguing. It had a lot to offer. It was interesting in a lot of regards. I just think that NASCAR needs to be prudent about this, and they need to make sure that they have all the data that they have possible before they go ahead and make the decision, because, you know, we've seen the sanctioning body make rash decisions in the past, and I think they react to public pressure a lot. And the narrative right now among fans in the garage, among fans inside and outside the garage, I should say, is that, you know, lower downforce is the way to go. And I think there tends to be a lot of groupthink in this sport. And, you know, just because everyone's forcing you to say, just keep taking more downforce off, doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what we need to be doing. It could be the answer, but I think that this experiment has showed us that there might be more to it than just, you know, just lower downforce. Because, you know, I keep going back, people have made, you know, the remark about how, you know, if it was on a worn-out track and with a better tire, maybe it'd be better. But the thing that I noticed is that whether it's a repave or not, your ability to close on a car ahead of you is related to aero. And it's not good if a car can't close up on a car ahead of it because the aero wake is messing the car up. And, you know, whether that's a repave or a worn-out racetrack, that's going to be a problem. And we've seen that the aero wake is not, at least to us at home, does not appear to be having that effect with the original 2016 package. So we'll just have to see. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be something that we're going to have to kind of keep our eyes on, because I think there's going to be a decision. I don't know if you've heard anything from some of the powers that be, but could we see a decision on this made for 2017 soon?
You know, I don't think they're entirely sure yet. The vice president of competition, Scott Miller, came in and talked after the race. He came in and answered questions and everything. And the general consensus so far was that, obviously, this one in particular is going to take them a long time to analyze the data from, because there was so much to it. He confirmed that we won't see this run in the chase at all. So that's one thing to note. So unless they decide to run it the next, I think, is it 7 races to the chase now?
Yeah.
6 or 7. So unless they decide to test it one more time in one of those, we won't see it again this season. But he seemed like he would be, if they talk about it, they don't seem inclined to run it again this year. But if they come back with the data and decide they want to try it again, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw it. But I don't necessarily think it's going to be implemented for 2017 as of now. I don't think that the feedback has been as overall positive as the other one was. I mean, last year when they tested that package that they're running this year at Kentucky and Darlington, it was miles and above and noticeably better.
Yeah.
And I think the general consensus from pretty much the entire paddock was to, hey, let's implement this, let's get it going. Some drivers even said they wanted it for the chase, and obviously NASCAR backed off on that for probably good reason, to be fair, to how the season had gone. But I don't know. I just really wish we could see this on a more typical 1.5 mile track if they were going to run it on one. I know there aren't any left until the chase, which might be why they still went with Kentucky. It's kind of strange how for all the 1.5 miles we have in the chase and early in the season, this summer stretch has almost none. But I don't know how much we really learned last night that we can take away from it. And I want to see it at least one more time in a trial scenario personally before they make any decisions on trying to implement it for a full season, because I'm actually with you on this. I don't quite think they have enough or have seen enough from the two races they've ran it in to really show that it's absolutely worth implementing for 2017.
Indeed. Well, we do know one person who liked the 2017 package, and that was Brad Keselowski. Keselowski is on an absolute heater right now, coming off a victory in Kentucky, and then a week before that, he won in Daytona in dominating fashion. Keselowski is currently sitting on top of the chase grid at the moment with four victories, and he's only 4 points out of the points lead as well. Brad is such an interesting character. He's an intriguing character, and Team Penske is really starting to come out of nowhere, it seems. You know, we didn't get a chance last week to go over his win in Daytona. I personally think that his Daytona victory was one of the more impressive driving performances I've seen this season. He was miles ahead of everybody that night. I mean, it was really a treat to watch him and battle those Gibbs cars all night, and he just, you could just tell that it was really two really unique Brad Keselowski-type performances, where Keselowski just, he goes in with that mindset into these races where he doesn't let anything get in his way. I mean, I think that's made him a great plate racer and has helped make him really good in fuel mileage situations, like we saw this past week in Kentucky. Give me your take on Keselowski here as we edge a little bit closer to the chase.
Well, you know, I think it's really easy for people to forget that this guy is a champion of the Sprint Cup Series. He made that run in 2012, and it was no joke. He beat out Jimmy Johnson to win that championship when Jimmy Johnson was still running pretty peak Jimmy Johnson. I mean, yes, he had some bad luck during that run, but Keselowski went out and earned a championship. And really, for a team as amazing as Team Penske's been for so long, they've just never really been able to get over that championship hurdle. And Keselowski brought them a championship that, I mean, two decades couldn't bring them. So he's a very underrated driver. And I think these last 2 weeks have shown just how much of an incredible driver he can be when circumstances are right. I mean, they were two polarizingly different victories. Daytona, he showed that he can go out with a great car and dominate the field at really one of the hardest tracks to dominate the field.
Yeah.
And then he goes to Kentucky and shows, as he's done many times throughout his career, that when you have fuel mileage races or you need a race with strategy, he and Paul Wolf can work together. And I don't know how he comes up with the fuel numbers he does, but it seems like every time there's a fuel mileage race, if he isn't winning, he's in the top five, because he just always stretches it to the end. And I think Keselowski has honestly kind of been overshadowed the last couple seasons by Joey Logano because of how strong Logano's been, making the championship four in 2014. And winning so many races up until the Kenseth incident last year. I think it's almost like Logano, as amazing as it is, jumped ahead of a champion 2 years after he won the championship in the pecking order there for a while. And I think this year, while Logano was also starting to come in for his own, save for that nasty crash he had on Saturday, Keselowski's kind of, I guess in a way, reminded everybody just how talented he is. Because he hasn't had the best car for very many races. I think there's still something to look at there. They were still lacking a little bit in speed. I think Kevin Harvick's car was faster.
Yep.
And I know Martin Truex Jr.'s car was faster. He had a rocket ship.
Well, we'll get to that next.
So for Keselowski to come out and get that win was, I think, a testament to him, a testament to Paul Wolf. And now that he's got four wins going toward the chase with seven races left, I mean, he's playing with house money. He might enter the chase with five or six if they can play another strategy gamble. So, really, I would say a month or two ago, I wouldn't have picked Keselowski as a favorite. But as the chase gets closer and closer and this whole Team Penske organization starts picking up momentum, you really have to wonder if he's going to be one of the ones that's going for the title in Homestead.
Well, I think a really interesting point that you bring up is that Team Penske appears to be peaking right now. If you go back to the last four races that we've had, Team Penske's won three of them. So, take a look at last year. I mean, it was right around this time of the season, you know, right when Kyle Busch got that win in Sonoma, and then he followed it up 2 weeks later with a victory in Kentucky. That's really when Gibbs hit their stride, and they ended up carrying that momentum all the way through until the end of the season. Team Penske has had a very similar trajectory this season. If you go and look at everything, you know, they were they weren't that great to start the season. They were a little off. They got a win here, they got a win there, but they didn't have the week-to-week speed that the Gibbs cars did. Nowhere even close. That's how the Gibbs cars were in 2015 to start off. They did not have the speed that Hendrick and the SHR camp had at the beginning of 2015. And then by mid-season, they really kind of started to pick it up. They clicked off a couple wins. And then by the time the chase rolled around, those cars were just dominating. And they ended up carrying that all the way through the beginning of this season. So we're seeing almost the exact same thing now with Team Penske. It's important to not peak too early in this sport. I think a lot of people put the Gibbs cars on a pedestal early this season, and I think that's dangerous. And I think the Penske cars are peaking right now. At least history would show us to be at the correct time. And that's going to be interesting to watch as we get towards the end of the season. If Gibbs is kind of being put on notice right now, they've been sitting on the throne all season long, and they're very strong right now. Don't get me wrong, that Toyota camp is really good right now, but they better be looking behind themselves a little bit, because Keselowski and Logano are ahead of all. Keselowski's ahead of all the Gibbs cars in points right now. Logano's ahead of three of them. So that's an interesting point that I think we're going to need to watch here as we get towards the end of the season, because we know Keselowski and Logano are both capable of making a deep run in the chase. I mean, they've done so multiple times over the last couple of seasons. Logano made the final in 2014. Keselowski nearly made the final race in both 14 and 15. So, I don't know, man.
I don't know, man. Team Penske's just really showing their stuff right now. And I think you still can't sleep on Joe Gibbs Racing, because they've shown speed. And as we've seen in the chase, if you have speed and can rattle off some wins when it counts, you can make a really deep run in that postseason. And, I mean, you have to be able to more or less win the last race of the season to get the championship. So don't count them out. You obviously can't count Kevin Harvick and Kurt Busch out either, because they are right there. And there's just a lot of teams peaking right now. One thing I do want to mention real quick, though, is one team that is not peaking is Hendrick Motorsports.
Yep.
They are just, as this summer goes on, they are just dropping further and further. I mean, Chase Elliott, he was up really flirting with the top five in points, and while he's still safe right now, his little, what would you call that, a twin duet spin there? It was almost like a ballet.
It's like synchronized.
Yeah, it was beautiful. I'd have gave it an 8 out of 10. I don't know what the Olympic committee thinks, but Chase, he's dropped back to 8th. Jimmy Johnson, he's only got, I think, 2 top 15 finishes in the last, like, 8 or 9 races. He's been abysmally bad.
Oh, yeah. I got a stat for you here. I got an interesting stat of the day. Jimmy Johnson has finished 15th or worse in 7 of the last 9 races.
That's incredible. I can't think of any point in really his whole career where Jimmy Johnson's had that bad of a run. That, I mean, part of it's been bad luck, but you've seen issues. Like, on Saturday, he just lost it by himself twice in the weekend. He did it during practice, had to go to a backup car, and he did it again in the race, and it killed his night. I mean, he's struggling. Chase Elliott's dropping, although I still think Chase, unless he has a big failure, a bunch of wrecks or something, he's still a full race ahead of the cutoff, I think he's fine.
He's in good shape.
But you look at 13th in the points, and I think there are quite a few members of Junior Nation that are starting to get very antsy.
They should be. They absolutely should be. I mean, take a look at where the points are lining up for Hendrick right now. They don't have anybody higher than 8th in total points scored. Jimmy Johnson, I mean, despite getting those 2 wins earlier this season, he has been out to lunch for most of the season, really. He got a couple wins early this year, and they weren't what I would call amazing victory. They weren't impressive victories. They were, him and his team kind of benefited from some late race cautions and some strategy in those 2 race wins that he got. That team has not had speed this year. Anywhere, really. They haven't had speed on the super speedways. They haven't really had speed on the mile and a halves. He's been average at best on the short tracks. It seems to be a systemic problem. With the exception of Chase Elliott. I mean, Chase Elliott, that team is like an anomaly right now as far as Hendrick Motorsports is concerned. I mean, the Hendrick cars are 8th to 15th place cars most weeks for most of the season. I mean, Casey Kane is completely out to lunch right now. Junior's team, I think Junior's doing a pretty good job driving those cars, but I don't think the the team is stepping up for him. It's appeared to me like he's been getting more out of the cars than is capable. I mean, same with Johnson. I don't know what is going on with that team right now, but they are definitely off. And I don't know if that's going to mean that they're going to maybe peak later in the chase. I mean, Johnson's got two wins in the bank. Chase is definitely good enough on points. I think Junior should be safe. But you're right. I don't know what to make of that team right now. This goes back to at least the end of 2013. I mean, since Johnson won that championship, man, that team has been out to lunch, with the exception of Gordon in 2014 making that run at the chase. Hendrick Motorsports has fallen behind a little bit. I think it's safe to say at this point that they are possibly fourth right now on the pecking order of Sprint Cup teams. Would you disagree?
No, I wouldn't disagree. I think, really, save for Jimmy Johnson, who, I mean, you can always count on him to rattle off at least a win or two in a given season. He's won every season since his rookie year. I think, really, save for him, the organization really hasn't even looked too capable of winning most weeks.
No.
I know Dale Earnhardt Jr., he has quite a few runner-up finishes this year, but if you look at most of those, a lot of them have been late-race scrambles where he's just, by virtue of being in the right lane at the right time on the last restart or things like that, has been able to rise up. And I've never really seen a race this year from him where I thought, oh, Earnhardt's going to have a shot at the win here in the last five laps. He's going to pull off the pass. Chase Elliott, I think, has honestly been the only one on the whole team over the summer that I thought had a shot here in a week or two. I mean, he was great at Pocono. He was great at a few races back in June and May. And even he's had his struggles here as July's gone on. I think hitting a little bit of that rookie slump as the season goes on. Casey Kane, he shows the occasional good run, and I'm not ruling him out of the chase just yet because he's only 16 points out right now. But he's, once again, I mean, as time goes on and you keep thinking Kane needs to make that step up, you keep thinking he's going to do it and get to victory lane, he's finding himself on that chase bubble once again, and once again he's on the wrong side of it as the chase gets closer and closer. I would really be worried if I was a Kane fan, and really, although he's barely safe because there's quite a few drivers still behind him, I wouldn't be feeling too safe if I was a Junior fan. I'm still staying by that. If he keeps wrecking and having bad luck, I mean, he's only, what, he's 32 points ahead of Trevor Bayne in 16th right now, and that's not to say that somebody like a Kyle Larson or an A.J. Allmendinger won't win here as the summer goes on, get to tracks like Watkins Glen or anything either. I think really anybody from about 12th on back right now that doesn't have a win has to be really nervous, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Casey Kane are both in that group.
You know, we're going to be talking about the chase on this podcast a lot in these coming weeks. And this, to me, since we went to this new 16-team chase format, I think this is shaping up to be the best chase battle in terms of the race to get into the chase that we've had in quite a few years. Last year's was pretty much non-existent. It was pretty cut and dry who the 16 were going to be. It's pretty early in the summer. We had a pretty good sense of that. For the most part, same thing in 2014. But if you look at it this year, what are we going to say here? I'm thinking Chase Elliott's in pretty good shape. There's three spots, I think, that are left in the chase that are pretty much up for grabs. And I think that everybody down to at least 21st in points has a very legitimate shot at making that final 16. And, I mean, look at Trevor Bayne. That team is not going away. That team has been pretty solid this year for the most part. They've been pretty consistent lately. He picked up a third in Daytona. He got an 11th place finish in Kentucky. Trevor has got a completely renewed confidence about him. He's up to 16th in points. The Fords are really starting to turn it around, I think, in general. I wouldn't be shocked to see a Roush car steal one of those spots. I mean, especially if the Hendrick cars keep slumping. Ryan Blaney, I mean, despite wrecking last week, he's shown tons of speed this season, especially with his Team Penske teammates coming around. Or corporate teammates, I should say. He could easily get a win. Kyle Larson, I mean, he's sitting 19th in points. And he's shown a ton of speed this year. I mean, he's almost won a couple races. So we could really see this go right down to Richmond. And I wouldn't be shocked if we saw someone win their way in at Richmond and maybe give that race some much-needed drama, because that race has been pretty dry. the past few years, since the Spingate incident in 2013, man. That Richmond race has been a wasteland.
Yeah, it hasn't necessarily had the chase cutoff excitement that people have been wanting from it, but I mean, as this year goes on, there's so many drivers right there on that bubble, and I really, it's hard to predict who's going to make it. I think Ryan Newman's just doing what Ryan Newman does best, which is run just consistent enough to make it in. He's up to 12th in points after that surprising third place showing, so he's looking fairly good. And while I did just give him a lot of grief, I do think Dale Earnhardt Jr. will make the chase.
Yeah,
I think the five top fives kind of speak for themselves, and he's had a share of woes over this year, but I think those occasional times when he does have a good car, his car has enough speed in it, which I think is always the key. He has enough speed in it that when he has a good car, those runs that are really well kind of counteract the ones that are poor.
I would agree.
So I would say Junior will probably make it. Austin Dillon has 8 top tens. He's kind of slumped over the summer a little bit, but he's still there. And really all of them, they've all got a 20-plus point cushion right now to the 16th place cutoff. But really, if you look back there, I mean, Jamie McMurray's trying to ride consistency all the way to it. His teammate Kyle Larson's trying to drive through the field like a madman and win a race to get it. Trevor Bayne's playing with house money because this time a year ago he was struggling to stay in the top 30, let alone the top 15. So for him to be the one leading the charge for Roush is very phenomenal, and I think speaks a lot to his character and talent as a driver. I think if any of the Roush cars make the chase, it will be Trevor Bayne.
I agree.
By virtue, I just think he's been more consistent this year. I think Stenhouse has the ability to perhaps run a little better when he's peaking. And, I mean, he's not been himself this year, but we all know that if Greg Biffle ever got a good piece, he could pull off a feat kind of like Tony Stewart did at Sonoma and rattle something off. But it's going to be interesting. There's about 50 points separating 14th and 15th from 20th and 21st. So really anything can happen in these last few weeks before the chase because there's so many wild cards still on the table.
Yeah, I want to go back to Trevor Bayne really quick because I don't know if I've seen a turnaround like that in a while. I mean, Trevor looked lost last year. And, you know, the Roush cars are definitely better this season, but they're not, like, so much better where you can just point, say, it's all the car. Trevor has made quite a turnaround, I think, as a driver this year. I mean, he's got a completely renewed confidence about him. You know, I think a lot of people really wrote him off after last season, and he showed so much promise coming into the sport in 2011. I mean, people forget just how much of a phenomenon he was after he won the 2011 Daytona 500. I mean, everybody wanted a piece of him marketing-wise. I mean, he was a big deal. I mean, he almost became the next breakout star of the sport. And it was a little disheartening over the last 3 or 4 years to kind of see him struggle, especially in his first full Cup season last year. And, you know, there were points in time watching that kid race last year where you were just like, man, like, what happened? And then he comes back this season. He's just been a completely different driver. And if he makes the chase, that would be a heck of a story because that would be well-earned, in my opinion.
Yes. I think if Trevor Bayne makes the chase, the first thing you have to do is look back to Charlotte in May and the opening races for the All-Star race.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that moment when Trevor Bayne made those aggressive moves, he drove through, obviously won that first opener, and then he drove really well in the actual race itself. He was very aggressive, and I haven't seen that from him really since he came to Cup, that level of aggression and that willingness to go and do whatever's necessary to run well. I think that was a big turning point for him. And if you look, I mean, he's just ran so well in the last few races. He's not necessarily the most consistent. He has a pair of 25th place runs, one of them actually in the Coke 600 the following week. But in the last 5 races, he's only had one finish below 15th. And I think that kind of consistency right now is what he needs to carry him into the chase. Is quite frankly, everybody else in the field is really struggling with inconsistency around that chase bubble right now. I think if any driver right now in that little area within 20, 30 points can run consistently in the back half of the top 10 or even potentially top 15 over these next few races without any issues, I really think they'll make it. And given the way he's ran the last few weeks, I mean, he doesn't have a DNF all year. I think Trevor Bayne could actually be the one to get this done. He's completed almost every lap in the entire season. It's completed 99.7% to be exact. I think that's been a big change for him this year compared to last year, and I think that's the kind of thing I look for when I'm looking for one of these drivers on the bubble who might have a chance to sneak their way into the chase. Because some of them, like Austin Dillon, for example, have been having problems where they wreck out and they're going to give up a lot of points. And I think that's where drivers like this who can find this consistency will shine.
Yeah, I think that's really going to be the key. There's been so much movement from like 14th to about 20th over the past 5 weeks, and it's because these guys are really inconsistent. I mean, 1 week they're putting up a top five, the next week they're DNF, and that's not going to get you into the chase. You got to be consistent. If you don't have wins, it's imperative that you're consistent. And I'm with you. I think Trevor and that Roush team, they're getting better every week. Their trajectory is positive. And they're kind of starting to come together at the right time. To be honest with you, I'm not ready to say a Roush car is going to win a race. I don't think they're quite there yet. But if Trevor keeps putting that car up into the top 10 and top 8 or so into a race, and you get a strategy break here or there, it would not be inconceivable for him or Stenhouse, for that matter, to break into victory lane. I think that would be a great story all around because, man, that team has just been so maligned, and it would be great to see that team rebound a little bit. Any final thoughts on this before we move on to some Daytona talk?
Just real quick on Roush, while the Cup team's running really well, Darrell Wallace Jr., after his fifth-place run in the Xfinity Series, came out and kind of said that he expects better from this team, even though he was happy with that run. I think it's interesting that as the Cup team has gotten better, the Xfinity Series team has taken a bit of a step down. Yeah. But at the same time, I think as the Cup team continues to get better, I think that will eventually trickle down to the Xfinity Series team. I think the organization as a whole is just kind of going through learning, kind of growing pains in the learning curve right now. It's one step at a time for them. But if you were to ask them, I imagine they would trade Cup results for Xfinity results any day.
Oh, I think that would certainly be the protocol, for certain, my friend. So real quick, before we finish up here, I want to talk a little bit about Daytona, just because we didn't get a chance to touch on this last week. Obviously, Brad Keselowski won the race, a pretty entertaining affair. But the big story coming out of that week was actually not the racing, but it was rather NBC, who came back to NASCAR racing and NASCAR broadcasting last week, and it was a big event for them. It was the first race on a broadcast network, meaning NBC or Fox, since the Coca-Cola 600 back in May. And there were a lot of complaints about the number of commercials that were shown. There were a lot of complaints about the broadcast. Personally, I watched the race. I've watched the past two races on the television. I thought the broadcast quality was fantastic. What do you make of NBC? What do you make of their commitment to the sport? What do you make of some of these complaints you've heard about the commercials versus the racing?
I think NBC's fine, and I don't think the commercial hubbub was quite as bad after this weekend at Kentucky either.
No.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned the two races to be aired on Fox or NBC were the Coca-Cola 600 and this Coke Zero 400, which Coke's getting them major sponsor points, but those races were also the two highest in commercials. I don't know if you saw, I did the math on it, and while I don't remember the exact percentages, it was around 25% for both of them. The Coke 600 was actually a higher percentage of the whole broadcast's commercials than this one was. Now, if you take into account the side-by-side commercials, they were a little closer, and I see how that could be an issue for some fans, specifically the ones watching on mobile, because it's my understanding that they don't get side-by-side coverage during those. So that makes a little more sense to me, because that bumps it up to about 31-32% for both of them. So there, I think there's something to be said, and there might be some improvements to be made, but airing these races, I mean, it's not a charity case. If they want to see these races on TV, you're going to have to put up with the commercials, because it's just, I mean, they have to have money and incentive to air them on those channels. And if you want the races on Fox or NBC, I think you're going to see more commercials for those bigger races and those bigger broadcasts than you are for one that's on NBCSN or Fox Sports 1. I think that's just the nature of it. I think the NBC broadcast group themselves did fine. I think the race at Daytona was phenomenal.
Yep.
I mean, I really don't have too much else to say about it. I think it was one of those things where, weird as it is, there weren't too many negatives to take out of the race, so that one just kind of became the big hubbub that everybody blew up about. I personally didn't find it to be that bad, and I think didn't either. as the year goes on, I think that people will kind of realize, hey, it really wasn't that terrible.
Yeah, I just think it's so weird. I follow Jeff Gluck's race ratings every week, and I was so shocked this week to see that Daytona race, which, to be honest, I thought that was one of the three best races of the season. I thought that was by far the best plate race of the season. I thought that was the best plate race since 2014. Just the battle between Keselowski and the Penske cars and the Gibbs cars, that whole race was awesome. I thought that was an excellent restricted plate race. And I was so shocked to see so many people who were just like on the fence about it. And it just confuses me to no end how fans could have been so divisive over that race. And I think part of it really was because of the commercials. And it really is funny. It goes to show that if your broadcast or if your race, whether you're NASCAR and you're focusing on the race itself or if you're NBC focusing on the broadcast, it just goes to show, man, if you're not perfect, the public will skewer you. And it, in this society that we live in, people just don't have a tolerance for imperfection anymore. Not that they should. But I think it underscores just how much of the perception of the sport is out of NASCAR's hands. Because, you know, we agreed that was probably one of the best races of the season, and it very much was marred by complaints about something that, in the big scheme of things, everyone's perception is a little bit different, but at least from my view, we're certainly not that noticeable. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those scenarios where perception kind of became reality to a lot of people, and it sucks because it was a pretty good race. I haven't seen the Kentucky rating for Gluck's little poll yet, but I think Keselowski's not obviously one of the most popular drivers in the garage, and I think the guy who wins the race also factors into that a lot. But it is interesting because the Talladega race he won was considered or was ranked fairly high in those. So,
which is funny because there was less passing in that race, which is it just blows my mind how this fan base works sometimes.
Lots of wrecks, though. But one thing I will say to qualify it, I know from watching it, it seemed like the broadcast had to put in a fair bit of commercials in the back half because the race went green for so long that they didn't necessarily have those breaks. And I think that's a fair point. I think, I mean, the networks can't really account for that. You obviously can't say, hey, I mean, I guess they could throw debris cautions or something if they wanted to, but you can't really go in and say, hey, we need a caution on lap 45 because we have to show them that water cooler Dale commercial again. Can y'all just hook us up? Can you get somebody to spin? That's not how it works. So I think that definitely factored into it. You know, there toward, I think it was around 60, 70 to go, we had a couple instances where they would have a commercial break, show three or four laps, and then go back to commercial. I think that's when it kind of became a big outrage and uproar, but it really wasn't that bad. I think overall, I don't think it's going to be something that sticks with people for too long. I think we've already kind of moved on to bigger and better things to talk about in a week, so I'm not too worried about it at this point.
Indeed. All right, that is all for the podcast for today. Mr. Bearden, final thoughts before we head off to New Hampshire Motor Speedway this weekend?
I want to give a shout-out to my man, Zach. I hope I don't butcher this, buddy. Catanzardi, I don't know exactly how you say it. He and I both worked really hard this weekend covering the race from Kentucky, so if you want to hook him up, give him a follow on Twitter at Zach Racing, and I'm at AaronBearden93. We have plenty of content for you. I pretty much just hide in a hole and ride all weekend. That's what I do at this stage. That's what Tom and the front stretch crew have kind of pushed me toward at this stage. So, just thanks to everybody for following along, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Indeed. If you want to follow the Front Stretch Podcast on Twitter, just follow me at mstalnik41, all one word. Or just follow Front Stretch at Front Stretch on Twitter. You can get all the updates, and you can download the podcast, comment on it if you would like, and make fun of us as much as you want. So until next time, I'm signing off, Matt Stalnik, signing off for Aaron Bearden. We'll see you next week after New Hampshire.